Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for December 8, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. First up, in about 10 minutes, we'll speak with Heather Boucher of the Center for Economic and Policy Research on a paper she did on whether women are opting out. There was a story in the New York Times a couple of months ago about how all these Yalies were planning to, when they had kids, drop out of the labor force and be stay-at-home moms. More recently, there was a piece that also in the Times saying that a lot of women, older women in their 40s and 50s, are dropping out of the labor force to take care of elderly parents or whatever. But anyway, are women opting out of work? Heather Boucher has crunched the numbers and has an answer for us, and I'll give you a hint. The answer is no. And then at the bottom of the hour, We should be hearing from Jonathan Tessini, who is a former president of the National Writers Union, a labor journalist, and proprietor of the Working Life blog, who has recently announced a couple of days ago that he is challenging Hillary Clinton in the New York primary, Democratic primary for United States Senate, challenging her from as an anti-war, pro-labor candidate who is trying to tap in to the sentiment that thinks that Hillary has been just a little too pro-war and anti-labor to remain the senator, the junior senator from the state of New York. So we'll get to that all in a few minutes, but first, some economic headlines. Last Friday, the monthly employment report for the month of November released, 8:30 in the morning, as it is on most first Fridays of every month. We learned that payrolls overall grew by 215,000, which is a pretty good number, a little below long-term historical averages, but a little above recent experience and much better than the previous 2 months, which were held down in part by hurricanes, but there was also a notable slowdown in employment growth outside of the hurricane states as well. A good rebound for the month of November, although certainly not making up what was the deficiencies of the previous 2 months. Private sector adding 194,000 jobs, government 21,000, mostly in education. Standout sectors, construction up 37,000. A lot of that, the housing boom, which I will say a little later, does seem to be running out of steam. But also some heavy construction work like highways and bridges, which may be hurricane-related reconstruction. Manufacturing added 11,000, which is unusual for that sector. The first two consecutive monthly gain in manufacturing in a year, and only the third such instance in the last 7 years. Still, this is not a gangbusters report. The share of industrial sectors adding jobs is well below the kinds of results that we saw in the 1990s when the labor market was much, much stronger. No gain. Actually, the work week fell. Work week sometimes considered a portent of future hiring. If the work week lengthens, that means employers have perhaps some pent-up demand to hire some new workers, but none of that there. Earnings also quite weak. Average hourly earnings now lagging, as they have been for the better part of a year, the inflation rate, meaning that real earnings are declining, and with hours down, weekly earnings down even more. So the employment report, good, but really far from great. The BLS also asked some questions, supplementary questions, in its monthly survey in the hurricane-affected areas in the Gulf. They reveal that about half of the 900,000 people who had evacuated the area have now returned. The unemployment rate for those who've returned is 12.5%. For those still away, it's almost 28%. Not such great news for people who were victimized by the hurricanes of the last several months. This morning reported that jobless claims, the tally of people who have lost their jobs and head over to sign up for unemployment insurance benefits, up 6,000 on the week when most people have been expecting a decline. Claims for the previous week revised upward slightly. So it seems that the unemployment claims numbers are stuck in a good but not great region, as they have been for some time now, and as I've been saying for some time now. The Federal Reserve reporting yesterday a surprise decline in consumer credit outstanding. Some of that was expected because of a fall off in auto sales, meaning that people taking out fewer auto loans, but also credit card borrowing down. And in a separate report, it also we're seeing something of a slowdown in home equity borrowing. So this is interesting. After having borrowed like crazy, U.S. households do seem to be slowing that down, whether this is just a little blip or something to be taken more seriously over the longer term is not yet. It's too early to tell that, of course. But when things get interesting with borrowing is when it starts turning down. When borrowing is heading up, everybody feels good and the economy expands and nobody worries about debt. But when it turns down, you sometimes see a real contraction in the real economy. We saw that in the early 1980s. We saw that in the early 1990s very severely, and the consumer credit drop of the in October was the biggest since 1990. So this bears further watching whether something is going on here, whether the Federal Reserve pushing up interest rates and the signs of early signs of a slowdown in the housing market actually beginning to bite a little bit in the borrowing world. But consumers reporting to be more upbeat. ABC, the Washington Post weekly tally of consumer attitudes up another point last week. Now considerably off its lows, 7 points off its lows, post-hurricane lows. A lot of that, I think, has to do with gasoline prices. They're down. Consumer attitudes are up. And also, so is President Bush's approval rating in New York today's New York Times CBS News poll. And I think a lot of that is related to the decline in gasoline prices over the last couple of months. And productivity still gaining like crazy. Output per hour of labor was reported up 4.7% for the third quarter of this year. Compensation up just 3.7%. That measure includes fringe benefits, which have been dominated by really rising healthcare expenses. But even so, the compensation lagging. The gains in productivity, people able to put out more in an hour of work, but it's not showing up in their paychecks. So that's very good news for corporate profits, but not so good news if you're a worker. The Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, which is designed to forecast moves, twists and turns in the U.S. economy several months out, up last week following a couple of weeks of decline. So some stability in there that had been slowing down some through September, October, November, bounced towards the end of November. So maybe the economy is finding its feet, but it wouldn't be surprising to see some kind of slowdown next year. The Federal Reserve has continued to tighten, pushing up interest rates under its direct control. And it would be hard to believe that the economy wouldn't reflect that at some point, particularly housing, which, as I've said, is beginning to show signs of at least that bubble does seem to be showing preliminary signs of losing some air. Finally, the bankruptcy filings. There's a number that's going way, 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 way up. Up 37% from the third quarter a year ago. The previous quarter was up 11% from the second quarter of 2004. So a real boom in bankruptcies. 393,000 the first quarter this year. 532,000 personal bankruptcies in the third quarter this year. Certainly a lot of that increase the result of people rushing to beat the change in the bankruptcy laws, which are much, much more hostile to debtors than they've been in the past. So let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with Heather Boucher.
Listening is
And that an excerpt from, I think, a 1981 song by Essential Logic, Fanfare in the Garden, led by Laura Logic, who has since gone off to an ashram in India, I think. Reemerges every now and then to do some music, but is no longer the punk goddess she was 25 years ago. And now we're joined on the line by Heather Boucher, who is with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Welcome to WBAI, Heather.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Doug.
And as I said at the top of the show, which, of course, you didn't hear, we're going to need to lay out the background for this a little bit. A front page article in the New York Times a couple of months ago about how all these young Yale students, women, who were planning to drop out of the labor force when they got married and had children. More recently, we saw a story about how older women were pulling out to take care of elderly parents or whatever, just getting a little sick of it. Several articles along these lines in the Times over the last couple of years. Is there any truth to this trend of women opting out?
Well, no, Doug. There is absolutely no truth to the story that women are now more likely to opt out than they were even a few years ago. When you look at all women, and my research, I just looked at prime age women 25 to 44, so the women most likely to have kids at home, I found that the what I call the child penalty, that is the impact on a woman's labor force supply for having kids in the home.
That is, whether she's working or looking for work actively.
Exactly. This child penalty on her labor force participation has fallen consistently over the past two decades, including between 2000 and 2004. What I think a lot of the hype is about is that when you look at the raw BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers that you can get on the website, it looks like mothers' labor force participation rates have fallen dramatically since the peak in 2000. And in fact, of course, they have, but so have the labor force participation rates of men and people without kids. And so it sort of looked like that there's been this trend of opt-out among mothers, when in reality, it's not been kids that have been causing these lower labor force participation rates. It's been the lackluster labor market and the limited job opportunities.
I think I had you on the show a couple of months ago to talk about how the recession and this rather subpar recovery expansion has taken a toll on women, right? This has not been a kind portion of the cycle to the fairer sex, has it?
No, it certainly is not. This most recent recession, the one that occurred in 2001, has been the hardest recession on women in decades. Now, this is not to say that the recession was harder on women than it was on men, and this recession has been very difficult on men, especially with all the loss in manufacturing jobs. But when you compare women's experience in this recession with previous ones, it's been harder on women. I kind of tend to talk about this as, you know, as women have moved towards equality in the labor market in terms of employment opportunities, it appears that they're moving in terms of equality, in terms of difficulties, in terms of recessions. You know, one of the interesting things about this most recent recession that I've noticed over the past couple of months is that when you look at the industries that lost the most jobs over the recession, women lost a disproportionate share of the jobs in those industries that lost the most jobs. So to kind of break that down a little bit, if you look at something like durable goods, women were about a quarter of the employees in durable goods manufacturing. That's manufacturing refrigerators and electronics and stuff like that. Women were about a quarter of those employees at the beginning of the recession, but they lost over two-thirds of the jobs.
Is this a seniority effect, or could you know what's going on?
You know, I don't really know what's going on in terms of why it's been happening. I have some guesses. Some of it might be seniority, but that doesn't actually make sense, because when you look at the previous two recessions, women did not lose a disproportionate share of jobs in the industries that lost the most workers. So that would have to mean that women had somehow newly moved into all these manufacturing jobs just in the late 1990s. Which may be the case, but may not. But I think some of it, yes, it's unclear to me exactly why it's happening, but I'm not sure it's about seniority.
All right, well, let's return to a topic then. It's disturbing to me, having just turned 53 yesterday, to find that I'm now 9 years past my prime. But
no, it's a woman's prime.
Okay, right, yes. Men are ageless, right? Men have no expiration date, as I read
exactly.
recently.
Exactly.
You've got a table in this report, which I should say is available at the CEPR website, cepr.net. Right there in the front page is a link to this, and you can mm-hmm. download the report and look, read it for yourself. But the first table, you compare the women, prime-aged women in the labor force in 1984 and in 2004, and a couple of things leapt out at me. Women are less likely to have children now than they were 20 years ago, and considerably less likely to be married, which I'm not quite sure that's really entered the popular consciousness.
Those are two, I mean, I'm glad you pointed those out, and those are two very important numbers. You know, women are less likely to be married. You know, divorce rates skyrocketed and all of that. But, you know, one of the things that I point out later in the paper is that this group of what the media tends to call elite women, that is professional women in their 30s who have kids and advanced degrees, these women are actually far more likely to be married than other kinds of mothers in the labor force, or not in the labor force, but mothers out there in the population. And so a lot of this decline in marital status appears to have happened among non-professional women, which I think is also very interesting when you're thinking about this quote-unquote opt-out question. And then the share of women who have children has declined slightly. I mean, I wouldn't make too big a deal out of that because it's gone from 30.2% who have a child under age 6 to 29.7%, not a very large decline. And in fact, when you look at the fertility tables, we were sort of checking those against our data, I thought there was going to be a much sharper decline. And there really isn't a very large-looking change in the share of women with kids. I think it's the marital changes that have been far more significant.
Yeah, and you've almost made a career out of correcting the nonsense that circulates in the media. But a couple of years ago, Sylvia Hewlett made a big splash with her finding that career women just never have kids. You found out that they just have them a little later, right?
They have them later, and they're much more likely to be married when you look at career women versus sort of these high-achieving women versus women who just have college degrees or women who have high school degrees or something. These more advanced women with more advanced educations tend to wait until they're married to have kids, and they tend to put both off until their 30s. And there's been a lot of hoopla about that, but that certainly has been, I think that is a growing trend. But again, it's not so big that it's showing up in the overall fertility tables. The age at first birth has gone up slightly, and there are more older moms having a first child, but sort of in that broader range of the 20s and 30s, there isn't a huge demographic shift towards tons of women waiting to have kids.
But what would hacks do if they couldn't discover and then amplify spurious trends?
Right? Well, it's all about creating news, isn't it?
Yes. Well, you found out our secret.
Yeah.
Just looking through the report, though, I was just struck by you have some unadjusted figures, then you adjust them, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But the unadjusted labor force participation for women without children is below the level it was in 1984. So what happened to explain that decline?
You know, that is a very good question, and not one that I have spent a deal of time looking at because, well, first and foremost, this paper was responding to the opting out question. Nobody seems to really care that much about women without kids. What they're really concerned about are all these moms opting out. But it is true that when you look at the labor force participation rates of women without children, they have fallen from a peak of 85% in 89 down to about 81% in 04. So there's been a relatively sharp drop there. And that actually mirrors what's been going on with men, because men's labor force participation rates have been dropping as well. I think that some of that probably has to do with more women taking on education in their late 20s. So these numbers are for women between 25 and 44, prime-age women. And over that time period, you have seen more and more women going to graduate school. That may explain some of it, but certainly not all of it.
And we've also, in the last couple of years, seen a broad decline in labor force participation by everyone. It's just that we have a 5% unemployment rate now, but about 2 percentage points fewer of the population is in the labor force than was at the peak. So that's a little bit of a deceptive figure.
Well, and that 2 percentage points translates into about, 4.2 million people who would be at work if the employment rates were back where they were in 2000. So it's fairly large, you know, in terms of how many people aren't working.
Yeah, and very little talked about when you hear all this press about how well the economy is doing.
Yeah.
It's really not.
Exactly.
You then But several things have also happened in the labor force. The composition, racial and ethnic composition of the labor force has changed. What does that do to the overall pattern?
Well, we have a lot more Hispanic mothers in the population now than we did back in 1984. The share of Hispanic women in this age range just about doubled from about 7% up to about 15% over this 20-year period. And typically, Hispanic mothers are more likely to drop out of the labor force when they have kids. And you do see that, but it doesn't appear that that's a significant factor in explaining the lower labor force participation rates of women in 2004 compared to 2000. A lot, you know, each time I look at it, the blame really does seem to fall squarely on the economy rather than demographic changes.
So to isolate the effects of that, you looked at what you call the child penalty. So tell us a little bit about that process.
Well, what I did was ran a series of regressions that looked at women's labor force participation, controlling for, that is, sort of including in the regression, age, the woman's educational attainment level, whether or not she's married or not, whether or not there is a man in the household who's in the labor force, so either working or not, but to control for, you know, some income or family effects, along with the whether or not she has a child, and then critically, year effects to control for the labor market in each year. What's interesting is that if you don't include the labor market controls, you do find that the child penalty increased between 2000 and 2004. When you put in the controls for the labor market, you find that that supposed increase in the child penalty was really attributable to the greater negative effects of the economy on women's labor force participation in 2004 relative to 2000.
Why would the child penalty itself be affected by the state of the business cycle or the labor market?
Well, I don't know that the child penalty. Well, I have two answers to that. I mean, one, in the model that I looked at, I don't know that the child penalty would be affected by the labor market, but that all of that other stuff that was going on in that year was being sort of put into that variable in the regression. So if you're running a model and you've accidentally omitted a variable that was very important, other variables may look like they're taking on that importance when really they're not. But it is interesting because that you would ask that question the way you did, because I do think there is something about the economy today that might be having an effect on women's labor force decisions. We know that in the late 1990s, there was a lot of movement on work-family policies at the firm level. There was, you know, a labor shortage in some sectors, and firms were really taking a lot of steps to increase their workplace flexibility plans and making it easier for parents to balance work and family. And between the recession and now, we haven't seen so much movement. And I think that there's a sense out there that if employers have become a little less willing to sort of go the extra mile to make it easier for parents to work.
And yeah, well, so, it makes sense that we've seen a squeeze on all kinds of benefits.
Exactly.
Health insurance, pensions, so it wouldn't be too surprising to see any kind of squeeze on child friendliness.
Exactly. So it may be the case that, you know, if you're out there pounding the pavement trying to find a job, but you've got a three-year-old at home and you can't find a work, you may just decide to opt out because you may as well just spend that time at home and say that that's a choice rather than continuing to be unemployed and looking for work. So I think, you know, or it may be that the firms are not making it easier, which is making that decision harder for families to cope with the work-family balance stuff.
But just putting this in succinct bottom line terms, the penalty for having a child, that is the effect of having a child and whether a woman is working or not, has declined over time, not expanded.
Right? Exactly. It hasn't gone up. Don't believe the myth.
And then you looked at the media likes to look at so much, women in their 30s with advanced degrees. What's up with them?
Oh, pretty much nothing. Contrary to all the articles that you mentioned at the beginning of this segment, there has been no change, no statistically significant change in the child penalty pretty much for the past 20 years. And in fact, the child penalty for this group of highly educated women in their 30s has remained relatively constant and very close to zero. In fact, in most years, it's indistinguishable from zero. which is very interesting because this penalty is much smaller than for any other group that I looked at for less educated women or younger women. And it is also the case that highly educated women are much more likely to be in the labor force if they have kids compared to other women. So it's interesting that we'd be focusing attention on this particular group when really this is the group for whom very little has changed and for whom the child penalty is smallest. You know, I mean, I keep talking about this group of women, but I would just like to sort of point you over to the other half of the table, that there have been these phenomenal, phenomenal decreases in the child penalty for women with college degrees and high school degrees, even though we don't have sort of the full set of work-family policies that we think might make it possible for those women to work. Somehow they're just making it on their own.
Well, it all comes down to the fact that most women, like most men, just have to work. They don't have the luxury of opting out.
Yeah, they don't even have the luxury of really thinking about it, quite frankly. So certainly that does appear to be that's certainly what I have found in my research.
Well, I did a little poll of my own Yale class of 1975 on the class listserv, and that piece in the Times is about Yaleys. And the members of my class, who are like 30 years out of college, a sizable portion of them, who were among the pioneers of co-education at Yale, had either very irregular, unorthodox work patterns or weren't working at all, including a woman who had become a pediatrician. Certainly the women at Yale, students, were planning some kind of withdrawal. Could it be that we're really just looking at a very, very thin sliver of society where, you know, they marry hedge fund hotshots, and they can do things that just about anybody else can't, but it's very stupid to generalize from their experience.
I think that couldn't be that's absolutely right. I mean, the fact that the child penalty hasn't changed for this group and that today's Yale women are saying that they're going to act like yesterday's Yale women is indicative of that. These women have far more choices than almost anybody else in the economy, and they can do whatever they want, and what most of them seem to choose to do is to work full-time, but many of them choose not to, at least in the broader group. But these very specific Ivy League comparisons don't seem to be telling us much about what's happening with the rest of us.
And I've only got a minute or two left, but I did want to ask you this. I saw an article by Christopher Jenks, the Harvard sociologist, in the New York Review of Books, in which he pronounces welfare reform a success and has changed his mind. He initially opposed the end of welfare and now thinks it's a great success, and he focuses on the decline in the poverty rate among single-mother households. In a minute, what's wrong with this?
I need an hour. But, you know, the decline in the poverty rate is not the only way to be looking at whether or not welfare reform was a success or not. I mean, first and foremost, when you look at folks who've left welfare, there's a lot of variation in what's happened to folks. And it is true that some people become more impoverished, and many found low-wage jobs. But a low-wage job is going to put you, in most cases, just above the poverty line. I mean, it's a line that you draw in the sand that actually doesn't really mean much in terms of what people can actually consume. So that would be one criticism. I mean, but, you know, another criticism is that much of the research, in fact, I would say 98% of the research that I've seen on this topic ended in the early 2000 or 2001, because most researchers were trying to get their research done before the supposed TANF reauthorization in 2001. Well, we don't really know a lot about what's happened over the course of the recession because we don't have a lot of research out there. So, I mean, I think we'd be wise to kind of step back and wait until we've looked at what's happened over the recession to declare it a success or failure.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Heather.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Heather Boucher is an economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research and a single-person truth squad who cleans up the mess that other dubious pundits leave behind. Thanks, and we'll be back in a little bit. Let's take a station break and a musical break.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is a place to turn to. Peace.
Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping genocide singing. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my Oh my God, oh my God.
And we're also on the web, WBAI.org. And this is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. Let's take another musical break, and we'll be back with Jonathan Tessini.
I don't care who sings at your winner.
My art is better than your art. That's La Tigra and Kathleen Hanna shouting that claim, and I do love egotism. And I meant to mention this at the top of the hour, but I just, why not do it at the bottom? I'll apologize to Jonathan Tessini for making him sit on hold for another 15 or 20 seconds. But this is a boom time for conspiracy theories, and I've been bashing them repeatedly on this show. The World Trade Center was wired to explode. There was no plane in the Pentagon. Dick Cheney orchestrated it all from his secret bunker. But it's interesting that a 1998 report on the Defense Department classification procedures prepared by the consulting firm Booz Allen and Hamilton was recently posted to the Federation of American Scientists website. And in this, the consultants recommend the use of the Internet, quote, could reduce the unrestrained public appetite for secrets by providing good faith distraction material, end quote. As an example of such material, the consultants suggested a diversion, quote, list of interesting declassified material, i.e. Kennedy assassination data. So consider this, all you conspiracy theorists who love to email me and criticize my anti-conspiracy stance. Instead of analyzing all the rich material about capitalism and empire on the public record, you're doing the Pentagon's work for it by pursuing distractions. You'd almost think it was a conspiracy. Now, we're joined by Jonathan Tessini, who has been president of the National Writers Union for many years, was president, not has been, and is a labor journalist and activist, most recently keeper of the Working Life blog. And on Tuesday, he announced that he is challenging Hillary Clinton in the New York State Democratic primary for her Senate seat. And since I am no fan of Hillary Clinton, that brought a big smile to my face. So I thought I'd call Jonathan and ask him to tell us what's going on. Welcome to WBAI, Jonathan.
Pleasure to be here.
So Hillary Clinton, I mean, that's a pretty big fish you're going after there, or David to her Goliath, or whatever metaphor you want to use. Where do you think she's vulnerable?
Well, in so many things, frankly. I mean, you know, we've only been in this race officially for about 3 days, and our emails have been flooding in. The website has been really attracting a lot of traffic. The central issue is obviously the Iraq war. She is pro-war. She is, frankly, her position is not that far from the Bush administration's position. She is terrible, in my opinion, on health care. She's awful when it comes to the questions of globalization, and I think you can just go down the list, pro-death penalty. The list goes on and on, and it's as much a question of, you know, who really knows what her position is going to be today. And let's add a new one to it, which is the almost stunning thing of her adding her name along with the right-winger Pat Roberts from Kansas to a piece of legislation that would criminalize flag burning.
I read that in the New York Post the other day. Half of me was surprised and half of me wasn't, because she certainly matches her husband in the ability to pander. This flag burning thing. What idiocy? I mean, who burns flags ever? When was the last time a flag was burned?
I was just going to ask you, has that ever happened in your neighborhood? I don't know where that's happening. And in fact, I'm no big fan of the New York Times for many, many reasons, but the particular editorial they wrote was brilliant, which it was entitled Senator Clinton in Pander Mode. And it, in fact, said that they could not find a single instance of flag burning. I don't remember what the time frame was, but certainly in the recent past.
Well, her office, not the Times researchers, but her office couldn't name one, right? So that's just remarkable. But, of course, it allows her to look patriotic for her presidential run in 2008, I guess. Let's review some of the details of her record. What precisely has her stand on Iraq been?
Okay, so obviously she voted for the war, and not only did she...
She was not alone in that by any means.
That's correct, but there were also 24, 25 senators, Democratic senators like Ted Kennedy, Barbara Boxer, the late Paul Wellstone, who voted against the war. She not only voted for the war, but one of the things she's been saying, and again, it's slightly dishonest, is what she objects to is the administration's rush to war. In fact, Carl Levin proposed an amendment during that debate which would have required that the United States, before going to war, come back to the U.N. Security Council and go through the process again and come back to the Congress. It was a way of trying to slow down the process and say, we want to give inspection some more time. She voted against that amendment. So she was right in lockstep with the administration to rush out and go to war. Since then, she's pretty much been right along, lockstep with the administration, most recently in this little flurry that came about after John Murtha proposed bringing the troops home immediately. She sent out a letter to her constituents, I think it was very common on her part and very typical in terms of a tactic. She seemed to be making a difference in her position or changing, but it really was no difference. All she said was she believed that some troops' withdrawal had to begin in 2006. With no timetable when they were going to come back, nor how many troops would come back. So, in theory, you could say, let's bring back 5,000, 10,000 troops. The time frame of keeping the rest of them there could be 10 or 15 or 20 years. So she really does not have a position of bringing the troops home. And not only that, she's saying what she wants from the administration is a winning strategy in a situation where there is no winning strategy.
And we don't even know what victory means in this context anyway.
No, there can be no end to this war. There is no such thing as a winning strategy.
It was amazing that Howard Dean said that in a radio interview 2 days ago, and then suddenly he's retreating from that. He said, there's no victory under the current strategy. He
right.
said, so the watching the Democrats try to take a position on the Iraq war is really is quite something. It's like watching a contortionist go through his routine.
Well, it's appalling, and part of that is I think it's particularly very difficult for those people. You know, back when the war was debated, it was fairly close to 9/11, and rather than have some vision and some principles, what they all did was read polls, and people were afraid, and people were scared, and people were lied to, and so the ones with no courage and no spine, like my opponent, basically said, well, I'm going to look at the polls, and I'm going to follow the polls, and that's one of the reasons that she and others voted for it. And now they're stuck in a position where the polling, you know, the public sentiment, because people are dying there, is now reversed. A majority of the people think that the war was wrong and that they should come home.
Well, where does she fall in the Democratic spectrum? We've got Joe Lieberman, who today's Daily News reported may be the replacement for Rumsfeld when he leaves next year
as
Defense Secretary.
That was also in the... I think it was in the New York Times yesterday, as was the rumor that Lowell Weicker might challenge Lieberman.
Yeah. So Lieberman is out there pretty much the cheerleader for the Bush administration. And, of course, you have Murtha at the other extreme among the Democrats. Where does Hillary fall in that spectrum? Can you actually classify her?
Well, I think I would say she's very close to Lieberman, if not sitting right on his lap. She's very, as I explained before, she says we have to have a winning strategy and talks vaguely about withdrawal, but really gives no indication what that means, whether in quantity or in duration. So she's pretty close to Lieberman's position. You've got John Edwards out there who said, my vote was wrong, and is trying to now, you know, shift a little bit. And you've got John Kerry who has, you know, nobody knows what John Kerry really thinks, but he has some proposal about bringing home a chunk of the troops by the holidays, which is now, and then a phase withdrawal in the next year or two.
I'm talking with Jonathan Tessini, who a longtime labor activist and journalist who is challenging Hillary Clinton in the New York Democratic primary for Senate. What about some of our other positions? What about labor issues, your particular expertise?
Yeah, I mean, well, we'll attack this in a few years. Hillary Clinton sat on the board of Walmart for 6 years prior to Bill Clinton running for the presidency. People forget where she comes from. And as we talked about, this notion that she's somehow a liberal and somehow pro-labor needs to be examined in light of the following. She worked for one of the most anti-union law firms in the country, the Rose Law Firm. I wasn't really interested in all this stuff about, you know, did they do some strange financial deals? I mean, that's important to some people. But for me, it was important that she sat on the board of Walmart and, as far as we know, said nothing while Walmart was crushing unions and essentially strangling also small businesses. But in terms of labor, she didn't do anything. They also represented the poultry industry, which was extremely anti-union, Sprint, Beverly Enterprises. So she comes from a very, in my opinion, anti-union background, which she's tried to refashion herself now. More recently, when she spoke before the Democratic Leadership Council, she said one of the great things the Clinton administration did was NAFTA. So I'm looking very much forward to traveling upstate in the areas, the industrial areas, that have been creamed by so-called free trade, and saying, your incumbent senator is saying NAFTA was a good thing. Is that someone you want to vote for?
Where does she stand on labor law? Is she taking a stance on any of these kinds of issues about U.S. labor law and how difficult it is to organize a union under the present circumstances?
Not in a visible, you know, one thing about the incumbent senator, my opponent, is that she takes almost no leadership in anything of substance other than things like flag burning and, you know, things that really are not about what I consider to be dangerous issues and cutting edges where we need leadership. On the question of labor law, there's a bill called the Employee Free Choice Act, which is being pushed by the AFL-CIO. That bill will pass maybe in my lifetime if we're lucky. It certainly is not going to pass in the next 10 or 20 years because at the very least you need a filibuster-proof Senate, and there's some Democrats that are very bad on this stuff. She has signed on to that. But my point really is she signed on to that because this is a no-brainer. It's not really a risky vote. And to say, basically, politically, to put your name onto something that has no chance of passing is a very easy thing. The questioning really becomes when you really need her vote and something comes down between a choice, a close choice, and a need to have leadership, is she going to be there for labor unions? And I think the answer is no. I know a lot of union people in the city and the state who really dislike her intensely, and it's not about personality. It's about the fact that they cannot really get her to come out for them strongly. When they're confronting employers, she will not sign letters urging employers to stay neutral in organizing campaigns.
How has she voted on some of the Bush nominees?
On the Supreme Court, you mean?
Yeah.
She voted against Roberts, but took no leadership in trying to defeat him or push for a filibuster. And we'll see with Alito. I do not know whether she's made, frankly, I haven't looked at that, whether she's made a statement. But, again, it's interesting. You know where Schumer stands, and I'm not saying that I'm a big fan of Schumer because he also voted for the war, but at least Schumer has taken a leadership role and is pretty clear. Can anybody tell me what the other senator has done in that regard?
Well, what has she had signature issues that she has tried to make a name out of? I mean, her reputation or visibility as a senator to me, and I follow political news very closely, is kind of fuzzy.
Well, I think it's fuzzy because she's tried to be non-objectional to people, and therefore she has nothing principled to stand on and nothing concrete to say, this is what I champion. You know, here's another great example. You know, 45 million people have no health care in this country, 3 million people in our state alone, in New York State. Her conclusion from the debacle of health care 10 years ago, when they refused to take on the pharmaceutical industries and the insurance industry, was you had to take baby steps. So the most radical thing she did in health care was the photograph with Newt Gingrich talking about their joint effort to use technology to improve efficiency in healthcare.
Oh, yeah, it was better databases. Wasn't some really wonky thing like that?
And, you know, nobody objects to the idea of having efficient systems if that helps, but that is not the reason 45 million Americans don't have health insurance. And my position is we have to extend Medicare to everyone today, which is completely doable. She won't do that because that's confronting the big industries and the big money in the business.
Now, I noticed that Code Pink has been dogging her. A couple of days ago, they announced that they were planning to dog her in every public appearance she makes. My first thought was, boy, that's good news. My second thought was, actually, she might welcome that as a way of improving her reputation in the red states. If Code Pink doesn't like her, maybe the centrist and conservative masses might warm up to her. And then I start thinking about your candidacy. Is that somehow going to aid her move towards at least the appearance of being in the center politically, to have somebody opposing her from the left?
Well, let me say this in a few ways. One is it would be a dangerous thing for any candidate and any politician to sort of position themselves predicting what might happen in 2 years. And I think that's the problem with politicians like my opponent, who base it on polls and focus groups, because they don't know really then what's going to happen in terms of events, and they have no real guiding principle. The other thing is, you know, one of the things that we've done is borrow a slogan from one of my political heroes, Paul Wellstone, which is vote for what you believe in. And if you remember, Wellstone ran and was senator from Minnesota. He ran in areas that were very rural and relatively moderate to conservatives, and he got support there mainly for two reasons. One is people felt that he was authentic, that he wasn't a phony. And number two, he talked about things that you couldn't really put ideologically. I mean, health care, that everybody should have health care. You know, 45 million.
Hey, that's socialism, man.
Yeah, man, terrible. But, you know, there are Republicans and independents and moderates who don't have health care. And there are Republicans and independents and moderates who are against the war in Iraq and don't want to see people killed there. And there are Republicans and independents and moderates who don't want to see their jobs shipped to this, you know, authoritarian regime in China. I don't see my candidacy as something from the left. And I think that's something that freaks them out and will be a challenge to them, because they are constantly trying to pander and position themselves when I have what I think is an honest, authentic voice. People may not agree with me, but I know I have a very clear idea what I want to say, and I'm not going to change the positions.
That was an amusing exchange in Hannity and Combs the other night when Hannity, the right-wing host, was complaining to Combs. He said, "You liberals, one day you want to add troops to Iraq, the next day you want to pull them out. One day you're for the war, and the next day you're against it. Why don't you just make up your mind and take a stand on something?" And Combs, he had this nerdy, waffly answer that precisely illustrated Hannity's point. So if you take a stand on something, that might win you some points. Hillary does have this, or at least did until recently, have this fairly sterling reputation among a certain demographic, sort of your NPR listening, liberal but not radical, you know, audience that is figures very prominently in the New York State electorate. How can you crack that that aura around her?
Well, let me start by saying this. Look, I know this is a huge task, and it isn't about just the fact that I'm facing a celebrity and someone with very high name recognition. It's hard to run against any incumbent. 95% of incumbents win in this country. But having said that, you know, you never know a moment in time. And I think when I started thinking about this 11 months ago, I had a deep sense of the incredible anger in New York and across the country, but about the war. And I also had a deep sense that people did not, the general sense of her and the support for her was mostly about celebrity and about the fact that she has huge name recognition. And realistically, because she is a high-ranking woman, I have to be very frank about that. But I think if I can reframe who she is and really get people to think about what actually she believes in, what has she done, I think we're going to do very well. Now, that is not a small task. 2 years ago, you could never contemplate this kind of race, but the internet, the ability to reach out to people, both in terms of raising money, but also just to communicate. I think Howard Dean proved it. Others have proven it. I think that evens the playing field a little bit.
Okay, so what's your strategy?
The strategy was, first of all, to launch and get going. It's based, you know, it's on at a few levels, and I don't want to talk publicly about some of the things we're going to do. So let me just say generally. The first thing is to reach out to people via the internet, communications. And that our site, I think, is a good one. It's at, by the way, TicciniForNewYork.org. And we're reaching a lot of people. Number two will be to set up a grassroots operation. We're going to set up chapters throughout the state. And we've already gotten people who want to do that. I'm going to be traveling upstate next week, and I think if we can set up a network of chapters everywhere in the state, we'll have a great group of people to base our petitioning on. We have to get on the ballot. The petitioning is June and July, and if we can get on the ballot, I think that will show an amazing amount of strength and then draw even more attention and more energy to the campaign.
And, of course, New York State has some of the most restrictive electoral laws in the country. How many signatures do you need to get on the ballot?
Well, yeah, it's more than just signatures in terms of quantity. You have to get 15,000 signatures in terms of quantity, but you also have to get, of those 15,000, you have to get at least 100 in each of at least half of the congressional districts, if you can follow that. So they want you to show both quantity and breadth of support, which, you know, is not a bad idea in concept. It's just a logistical challenge. But I think we're going to get on the ballot. I feel pretty good about that prospect.
So obviously you don't have a gigantic campaign chest to pay people to go out and with the petition, so I guess you're going to have to find volunteers to do that, right?
Well, no. I think, you know, and obviously if listeners out there think this is important, we want to encourage people to donate to the campaign. You know, Howard Dean proved you could raise $60 million off the Internet in a campaign. Dennis Kucinich, when he ran, raised $10 million. Not many people realize that because the Dean money overshadowed that. But I think if we can raise a, you know, reasonable amount of money, we're not going to compete with my opponent on cash. We're not going to try to run an advertising thing. We want to run a grassroots campaign. I think it's there to be tapped into both on the questions of the war and the questions of our economic future. The advantage I have over other candidates, I can go into union halls. I've been doing that for, you know, the last 20 years of my life. People know me. I have a reputation. And even where unions might be hesitant about jumping out and going against the Clinton machine, I think I'm going to get access to those halls. I've already been promised that, and I'll get an audience with people.
And your lead issue is going to be the Iraq War? Or?
Yeah, the Iraq War is the central point, because I don't think you can it's hard to talk about other things when people are being killed, both Americans and Iraqis, in a war, and we've spent already $250 billion in the war, and that clock on the money is just ticking, because it affects everything else we try to do here. But for me, the wrong prior to the Iraq War is inextricably connected to all the other things I mentioned. You know, the fact that we have no real trade policy that is for working Americans, the fact that we don't have health insurance, universal health insurance, and down the line. So I think those things are inextricably connected, and I want to try to offer a vision of a different American dream and a different American future.
All right, well, thank you, Jonathan Tassini, and good luck with the campaign. And that website, again, Tassini for New York, T-A-S-I-N-I, for New York, all one word, .org. And you can find out all about the campaign there, Tassini for New York. Thanks for joining us, Jonathan Tassini. I've been speaking with Jonathan Tassini, longtime labor activist, journalist, and now a political candidate trying to unseat Hillary Clinton in the New York State Democratic primary. And I guess that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week. And let's go out with a little more music. This is from a group with the extremely alluring name, Lesbians on Ecstasy. Let's listen to a bit of their song, The Pleasure Principle, P-A-L. And as you remember, the principle is your pal, P-A-L. And this song plays off that.
Ms. Pope, please report to the principal's office.
Ms. Pope. To the principal's office. Hello, Miss Pope. I've been expecting you. Please come in and shut the door behind you.